B-A-I New York. I'm Chris Bingert Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Escuchan in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, El Distrito Colombia, here on this Friday, September 20th, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show we put the spotlight on El Salvador, but not just the country itself, but rather a new congressional caucus here in the U.S. that seeks to whitewash the crimes committed during Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele's state of exception, which still continues to this day. And in order to do that, we're going to spend the hour with Alexis Tumbelis, who is the executive director of CISPIS, the Committee in Solidarity with the People in El Salvador. Welcome back to the show, Alexis Tumbelis.
Thank you so much, Oscar. It's great to be back with Latino Media Collective and on WPFW.
Absolutely. And Alexis, along with CISPIS, has a new article that came out this month in NACLA entitled "New El Salvador Caucus Appears Set to Do Bukele's Bidding in Congress as Human Rights Violations Under El Salvador's More Than 2-Year-Long State of Exception Continue to Mount. A bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers seek to whitewash the abuses." And so with that said, let's begin by explaining what is the El Salvador Caucus. And to do so, let's hear from Florida Representative Matt Gaetz himself as he introduced this new caucus to the House. Let's take a listen.
El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, has converted El Salvador from the murder capital of the world into a reliable and stable partner for peace and security for the United States of America. The El Salvador caucus will exist to nurture and advance the U.S.-El Salvador relationship, to encourage strong borders, strong culture, and the strong reforms that President Bukele has put into effect. They've defeated the gangs, They've put prosperity on the march in El Salvador, and even the 70,000 people who are incarcerated in that country are not just seeing their lives wasted away. President Bukele has instituted a zero leisure policy where they are now restoring buildings and murals and actually rebuilding the country that so many of them had a hand in ravaging through gang warfare. The purpose of this caucus will be to vindicate the choices that President Bukele has made that indeed strengthen the U.S.-El Salvador relationship. And El Salvador's resurgence has not existed as a consequence of falling for the siren song of globalism. Instead, President Bukele believes that the way El Salvador can lead within Central America and indeed throughout the West is by being the best version of themselves, not being excessively reliant on some of these globalist institutions.
So that was Florida Representative Matt Gaetz describing in his own words this new caucus, the El Salvador caucus that he's created. Now, Alexis, I want to get your response about this, but obviously people can't see us, but you were obviously shaking your head as you heard Gaetz's description of this new El Salvador caucus. And along the way, we'll describe some of the crimes against humanity that's taken place during the state of exception. We've covered it several times with other guests with regards to El Salvador during the course of the year, since the state of exception has begun almost 2 years ago. But right off the bat, you heard his description of the El Salvador caucus. But I want to see if you give us your response after listening to that. And also, if you could tell us who comprises this new caucus, because I think it's very important to note that this has nothing to do with Republican versus Democrat bias here, as you explain.
It's really remarkable to listen to an elected member of Congress take to the House floor and repeat so clearly the talking points, the PR campaign that the Bukele administration has spent hundreds of millions of dollars over the past 5, 6, 7 years to repeat. I mean, it's shocking to hear the words that Bukele uses so often to talk about his vision just parroted on the House floor. And it's something that I think people in the U.S. need to be really aware of and concerned about, that there's a group in Congress that is now actively seeking to, exactly what he said, vindicate Bukele's choices. What are those choices? We're talking about an illegal suspension of constitutional rights for over 2 years. We're talking about over 80,000 people who've been arrested without warrants. And there are estimates by human rights organizations in El Salvador that up to a third of those people may have had absolutely nothing to do with criminal activity, with gangs, with anything. Hundreds of them have died in prison under the state's conditions. So those are the choices that Bukele is making. And so that there's an active effort in the United States going on within the United States government to whitewash, to normalize, to legitimize what the entire international human rights community, and we're talking organizations, bodies like the United Nations, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, have very clearly spelled out as a catastrophe for human rights, for constitutional law, for the state of democracy. And I think it's very telling that there's a group of people in Congress, not only who are willing to sign on to that vision, and certainly when you're hearing from people like Matt Gaetz, who are very close with the Trump campaign, you know, it's not a surprise that some of the people, you know, we're hearing a lot of those same authoritarian tendencies, obviously, from a lot of people in the Trump camp. So it's not a surprise in that regard that there would be people on the far right here in the United States who would look at what Bukele is doing and embrace it as a model, not only for the hemisphere, but maybe what they would like to see for a second Trump presidency here in the United States. So that doesn't come necessarily as a surprise from an ideological level, including because Bukele has really been actively cultivating these ties with the far right in the U.S. for the last several years and globally more recently. But I think it's a very big concern that it's a bipartisan group. There are two Democrats in the caucus, Vicente Gonzalez and Lou Correa. The other 12 members are Republicans, and some of them are among the most right-wing voices, among the most anti-immigrant voices that exist within the Republican Party. But I think seeing their efforts as well to not just be a platform, give speeches, but to actually try to shift the U.S.'s policies towards El Salvador is something that people in the U.S. should be very concerned about, that those efforts to normalize a catastrophe in El Salvador are happening within the U.S. government.
So like I said before, we've done numerous shows on El Salvador with regards to the state of exception, and even on Bukele's presidency since it began numerous times here on the show. So I would encourage everyone to go to latinomediacollector.com to listen to those previous stories, those previous episodes with numerous guests with regards to Bukele and his administration. But for the casual observer of Salvadoran politics, for those who may not be familiar with Salvadoran politics, can you tell us about a political report that mentioned a few MAGA luminaries that attended Nayib Bukele's illegal inauguration to a second term? I think this is important for people who don't follow Salvadoran politics or Salvadoran society in the same way as you and I have, to understand that sometimes the company you keep can say a lot about what the state of affairs are in the country, correct?
Absolutely. And I think people need to pay very close attention to, you know, to people's actions, even more so than their words. And I think there's a lot of Bukele's policies now that show that he's very clearly and very squarely in the right-wing camp, not just politically from an authoritarian point of view, but economically in terms of abandoning any efforts that had been made previously to build a social safety net, to have tax equality, to sort of reduce inequality in the country. There's been huge reversals, including on an economic front, in terms of poverty rates in El Salvador are going up, food insecurity rates are going up, and there's a lot of, you know, people's actions speak louder than their words. And I think something that's important to know about Bukele is that he's a very, very, he has dedicated a lot of resources and he has a lot of experience in PR. And so a lot of what he does is to sell an image of himself, whatever he thinks the image at the time needs to be. So when Bukele ran for president, he had done so as an independent, and he had previously been a mayor for the left-wing political party, the FMLN, in El Salvador. And so he had a lot of people convinced that he was the new left. He was to the left of the left. He was going to be the new generation of the left and bring the left forward into the 21st century and give the young generation a chance. And that was clearly all a wolf in sheep's clothing. Fast forward 6 years, he is defying the Constitution, breaking the Constitution to run again, which is illegal, unconstitutional in El Salvador. And what is the first international event that he attends after he is inaugurated for this second unconstitutional term? CPAC, here in the DC area. He was one of two international guests, along with Javier Milei from Argentina, and they are the new right-wing superstars that a very clear ideological camp here in the United States is looking to celebrate, uphold, to build alliances with. And Bukele apparently is all about that now. And I think what we have seen, there was an article in Politico that came out about the quote-unquote MAGA field trip to Bukele's inauguration. And that was, you know, it's hard to tell where some of these congressional people fit into this, because there's certainly people like Matt Gaetz who are in the MAGA camp and other people who went to the inauguration who sort of share that ideological perspective include Don Trump Jr. was there, Tucker Carlson was there, high-level people from CPAC were there, it sounds like. And so you're sort of seeing this very intentional pairing of a particular slice of the far right in U.S. politics. And that's something that there's been some really important investigative reporting by journalists from Enfado, which is an online news outlet that was previously based in El Salvador, about the lobbying that the Salvadoran government has been paying for to cultivate these particular relationships with the U.S. right and some influential voices on the U.S. right. So this is really interesting because these are not people who support Salvadoran immigrants here in the United States. And as many people know, you know, they're almost a third of the Salvadoran population lives outside of the country. And the majority of those people live in the United States. And that's been a phenomenon that's been happening for decades. But it's very telling, significant, distressing for me thinking about it, that the alignment that the president of a country would have is with a group of people politically in a country that are openly opposing welcoming migrants from that country, that are pushing for mass deportation policies. What does that mean, that this is who the president of El Salvador is aligning himself with in the United States?
I'm glad that you mentioned El Faro, because it is a Salvadoran publication that originally started in El Salvador, but has since moved all their operations to Costa Rica because of harassment by the Bukele administration. As a matter of fact, if you recall, about 2 or 2.5 years ago, El Faro sued the spyware Pegasus because they were being spied upon. And a spyware like Pegasus can only function in a country with government authorization. So the presumption there being that the Bukele administration, you know, pushed the spyware to attack journalists. And I bring that up because El Faro was cited with regards to the Bukele administration hiring lobbyists to target some of the congressional leaders, as you mentioned in your NACLA article. So with that in mind, can you tell us about Bukele's public relations background again, prior to him becoming president, and how the state of exception extends to freedom of the press? We are obviously going to talk about the human rights abuses, especially the reports that came out during the summer. But with regards to the freedom of the press, let's focus on this first before we go forward here, because I think this is a component of the state of exception in El Salvador that doesn't get mentioned often enough.
Absolutely. And I think there's just news actually that came up in the last day or two in El Salvador about reports of audio files that existed amongst people who were close to Bukele from years ago discussing the intention of spying on journalists. So that has been news, at least that has been circulating a lot in El Salvador over the last few days. And I think that there is a really important thing that makes complete sense about the type of chilling effect that a policy like the state of exception has. What is the state of exception sold as internationally, and clearly very effectively to be vindicated by the new El Salvador caucus? This idea that the state is finally taking action to go after criminals. Whereas in fact, the state of exception is a suspension of constitutional rights. It means the police can arrest anyone without a warrant and hold them for 15 days in administrative detention, at which point they're supposed to have some sort of hearing to find out whether there's enough reason to hold them for longer or not. And in many cases, the vast majority of cases, people are being held in pretrial detention now for 2 years, 3 years. There's initiatives to extend that for many years longer. And these are people who've never had a true opportunity to even prove their innocence in front of a judge. So what is the impact of that on any person in the country who wants to criticize what the government is doing? Obviously, it has an intentional chilling effect. And I think the work of Salvadoran journalists and journalists operating still in El Salvador needs to be commended, because they are doing so at tremendous odds, as are every union leader, every environmental defender, every organization that is willing to get out in the streets and criticize or even question what the government is doing, obviously feels themselves to be at risk, as do just everyday people. There was a really concerning poll that the Polling Institute at the UCA, the UDOP, University Institute for Public Opinion, released around the time of the last elections in El Salvador. And it showed that between 50 and 60% of the population felt cautious about sharing their political opinions. And that obviously has an effect all across the country. If you don't feel like you can say, even to your neighbor, what you really think about what's going on in the country, the fact that there's not enough money for food, that people are losing their jobs or being fired illegally, and you're worried that someone can call in an anonymous tip line on you and the police are going to show up, you might choose to keep that opinion to yourself. And it's very possible that those type of dynamics are also contributing to this perception that Bukele has very much cultivated about his popularity, because people are too afraid to say anything otherwise. And so journalists have been targeted in many ways. There are a lot of journalists who've had to flee the country. And if you look at, not just in the U.S., but regionally through organizations like the United Nations Refugee Commission, there's been a very significant rise in political persecution, asylum applications of people leaving El Salvador over the last few years. And that's showing up in the United States, but it's also showing up in countries all over the world in terms of people having to flee El Salvador because they don't feel safe. And the fact that news outlets have had to leave the country entirely is extremely distressing, and it is important for people to know that those dynamics are very real in the country, and that the government, on the flip side, is investing massive amounts of public resources in their own propaganda. There's Bukele has helped to found, because his background is in public relations and marketing from before he got involved in politics. And so there's like a network of online and print news outlets that are all connected to him in various ways, even though they're not government publications, but there's a whole network of online and print media that are associated with him, as well as there was a really important report that came out in Reuters about how many people are on the government's payroll acting as internet trolls, from like Twitter bots all the way to people who are on payroll to sit online all day to be promoting and boosting what the government is putting out, going after people who question or criticize. There's even a room in the legislative assembly where YouTubers who are pro-government have a salon. There's a very, very, very intentional and very expensive PR project going on with Bukele all the time. And this extension of that into the United States,
yes,
happening not just through private people like Tucker Carlson on his own show,
yeah,
but now being transmitted by U.S. elected officials, is a very disturbing development.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, before he got fired from Fox News, Tucker Carlson had Nayib Bukele on his show and had even gone to El Salvador as well to interview him. In addition to that, so I feel like the whole public relations component of his presidency and his background is like an hour-long conversation in and of itself, because it is something that, as you mentioned, has reached a point where people are afraid to publicly talk about their political beliefs. It almost reminds me of this component of what's going on right now, almost reminds me of the dirty war in Argentina, in that people were not trustworthy of their own neighbors when it comes to expressing their own political views or any opinion for that matter. So again, it's a crude comparison, but anything close to that is still, you know, cause for concern. So according to your NACLA article, damning reports from both Human Rights Watch and the Salvadoran human rights group Crisosal released separate reports last July on crimes against humanity during the state of exception. And before I continue here, I just want to say that we're going to create a link to this article on our Twitter account so people can learn more about the human rights abuses that these two organizations reported on. We can't get to all the details here, but I'm curious to know if you could tell us, where was Matt Gaetz and other Republican elected officials were when these reports came out? Because if there's anything equally disgusting as to the details of the human rights report here, is what these Republican officials were doing, sort of, as you said before, sort of on a field trip at a prison in El Salvador around the same time.
Yeah, I don't think the timing of the caucus is coincidental. I don't think the timing of Matt Gaetz going back to El Salvador with other members of the caucus after Bukele's inauguration, you know, within the matter of a month or two. Going back, they went on a visit of the new El Salvador's mega prison, which is now the largest in the hemisphere. And it is not coincidentally called the Center for Terrorist Containment, because everything that the Bukele government does is a propaganda moment, you know, and to reinforce this idea with people that if you're in that building, then you're a terrorist. And what about the union leaders who are in jail? What about the students who are in jail? What about the people who were rounded up to fill a quota who are in jail? By calling the new prison the Center for Containment of Terrorism is a psychological attack on the people who can come to defend the innocent people who've been rounded up when they've been labeled this way by the government as terrorists. It's very intentional and it's very consistent. And so, but you raise a really good point. So Bukele gets inaugurated on June 1st for this illegal second term. He goes to CPAC. Right around the same time, there are some major reports issued by Salvadoran and international human rights organizations that actually make a lot of mainstream news. There were a lot of big news headlines on the wires. They got run in a lot of dailies in the United States. There was a lot of visibility around the fact that, you know, over 300 people have died in state custody. There are children who've been killed. There's reports of torture and other crimes against humanity. These are very well documented, and they're finally getting out there in the mainstream news, getting more visibility. Another notable thing that happened around that same time is that, and this may come as a surprise, but people might remember that candidate Donald Trump threw Bukele under the bus in the middle of his speech at the RNC. And he went out there to say that the reason, you know, Bukele, he didn't say Bukele by name, but he said the president of El Salvador would like you to believe, this is what Trump said at the RNC, I'm paraphrasing, what the president of El Salvador would like you to believe is that the murder rate there is going down because he's rehabilitated all these criminals. That's not what it is. The murderers are coming here. And so what does this mean for Bukele, who has really seems to have put a lot of eggs in a Trump 2024 basket, that this would happen and that the entire premise of his success in tackling the gangs and making El Salvador safe was thrown under the bus by who presumably could be his biggest political ally in the United States, or who he might like to be his biggest political ally in the United States. So I don't think it's a coincidence that soon after that, members of the El Salvador caucus led by Gates go back to El Salvador. They visit the terrorist containment center, quote unquote, and they say, wow, imagine if these guys had made it to the United States, i.e. thank God Bukele locked them up. So I think there's an interesting inconsistency within the right that is a problem that Bukele has to manage, or that the people who have chosen to support Bukele from within the right need to manage. And so I don't think the timing of either of those things is coincidental, that the truth of the horrors of Bukele's illegal state of exception are finally breaking out again in the mainstream in the United States, and that even within the right, Bukele's policies are being questioned, not because Trump doesn't support the same lock 'em up, law and order philosophy, but because his investment, Trump's investment in throwing migrants under the bus and in throwing people who he can deem in a certain way, especially Latin American migrants, as he's done from the beginning of his previous campaign, he's so invested in that that he's willing to throw someone who other people around him are putting up on a pedestal as the model for the entire region. And I think what comes across in all of that that needs to be named is that who suffers the most from that type of rhetoric, whether Gates is saying what he's saying or Trump is saying what he's saying, is the Salvadoran community and Salvadoran migrants and people who are considering the need to migrate, in terms of the danger that that type of rhetoric and lies spell for people living day to day as migrants in this country, as we can clearly see from the recent lies around the Haitian community in Ohio. I mean, they have very real consequences. Yeah. And what is the message that you're hearing on the stage of the RNC or from Gates's video in the middle of the jail? You know, Salvadorans are dangerous. And that is something that all of us, anyone in the solidarity community, also needs to be vehemently challenging and opposing, especially at this moment.
It's a complicated sleight of hand that you just described here. And this complicated sleight of hand certainly explains why there's such heavy investment in lobbying in the U.S. to try to whitewash, as you mentioned in your article, what's happening in El Salvador versus the narrative that Donald Trump would otherwise voice upon Salvadorans. And I will say this about this whole story about Haitian migrants and all the nonsense that's been spewed for the past couple of days with regards to this. And I've been trying to crystallize this as best I can. But as a son of Salvadoran immigrants, you know, there's a part of me that doesn't want to give that story any oxygen, because as you just mentioned, it's a narrative that's very similar to that which has been foisted upon Salvadoran immigrants for years now, in the last few years. This criminalization, this demonization, all based on racism and xenophobia. And we have to find some way to not only fight it, but fight it in a very crystallized way so people can better understand. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Alexis Tumbelis, who's the executive director of CISPIS, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Vine a vengar con palabras a todos los muertos. Prefiero cantar una canción en los entierros. Vine a manchar tu pared con mi grito de esperanza. Calladas gargantas yo cortaré de una tajada. Yo peleo con el poder que coloniza mentes. No escupo balas sino palabras irreverentes. Santas son las sustancias que me mantienen despierta. Santas las plantas que el espíritu me alimentan. Mi rap no es femenino, solo feminista. No busco el poder porque yo soy un anarquista. No quiero dominarte, soy un artista. Te embrujan mis palabras porque soy espiritista. La magia de la música la traigo en las venas. Mi pecho un tambor, mi pulso una canción sin pena. Las alas de mi mente me llevan a donde quiera. Soy luz y oscuridad, pero mi bandera es negra. Mi bandera es negra.
That was Rebecca Lane, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. That is @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the El Salvador caucus here in the U.S. with Alexis Tumbelis, who's the executive director of CISPIS, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. And CISPIS has a new article in NACLA entitled, "New El Salvador Caucus Appears Set to Do Bukele's Bidding in Congress." And like I said before, we're going to create a link to this article on our Twitter account so people can learn more, because Alexis, I want to have a little bit of fun right here, because this article, it seems like CISPIS reporting on human rights abuses in El Salvador hit a nerve with Matt Gaetz, as he recently responded via Twitter to your organization's work. Can you give us a few highlights or lowlights, however you want to put it, to his response? And I'm a little tickled here. I'm going to try to find a way to link this as well so people can see it on our Twitter account. But I was quite amused that this article got under his skin in the manner in which he did. and his characterization of Sisyphus is equally as hilarious as well.
Well, I think it just speaks to the fact that all we did in the article was lay out the series of events and lay out, in their own words, what members of the El Salvador caucus are doing, what they're promoting, and what they are, in his own words, vindicating, with the choices that President Bukele is making in El Salvador that they want to vindicate. And by even just pointing that out, we have drawn the ire of Matt Gaetz, apparently. And this was an official El Salvador caucus statement that's published on the El Salvador caucus website, the caucus responding to Sisyphus attacks, in which basically he, I mean, it's a classic right-wing move, and that's all that there can be said about it, and that the right-wingers, they learn from each other about these types of strategies, and that, you know, he basically accuses us of supporting human rights abuses, and it's like, okay, you know, like, this is what the right wing does. And this, and it's also worth mentioning this, because this is something that Bukele is very, very adept at. And I think it's important for people to understand how much of an intentional strategy this is, in that, you know, if your government is corrupt, you go after others, charge them with corruption, throw them in jail for corruption, run them through the mud in the media on allegations of corruption, whether there's any proof about that or not. And that's something that we've seen time and time again in El Salvador, as more comes to light about very outrageous levels of payments to people in the government, outright corruption. You know, what is the Salvadoran government's move is to go after their political opponents and use the power that they have co-opted by installing their own attorney general, installing their own judges, go after those people, accuse them of corruption, throw them in jail, and don't let them out until they are forced to do so by public pressure. And so, you know, I think in that sense, That's all that can be really said about that. In terms of, I think when you strike a nerve, hopefully that's because people recognize the truth in what you're saying. And it's hard not to see the creation of this El Salvador caucus coming right when it does, on the heels of Bukele getting inaugurated for an illegal term. And I need to say how significant that is, because there are many people in El Salvador now who would say that they are living under an illegitimate regime. Like, this is a de facto government. This is a government that was not allowed, should not have been allowed to take office, because doing so violates at least 6 articles of the Salvadoran Constitution. And so it's not a coincidence that in the wake of that, in the wake of reports that are searing and damning and horrifying, that people are seeing and paying attention to, that we would see this effort come together to try to paint Bukele's El Salvador as a model that other countries should follow, maybe even that the United States should follow. And I think that should be something we should all be concerned about. And I think it's also important to note that it's not as if they need to respond to any big moves by the Biden administration to criticize what's happening in El Salvador. I do think that that's important to point out. These criticisms and that the type of exposure that they're getting in the media are coming from human rights organizations on the ground in El Salvador and internationally. It's not as if the Biden administration has come out really hard against what Bukele is doing, and now they need this counter effect from their right-wing allies. The Biden administration has been very silent about the abuses that are happening in El Salvador. And I think that's the type of thing that makes it acceptable for any Democrat to join a caucus like this, because the Biden administration sent a delegation to Bukele's inauguration. They sent members of the Biden administration, and the Biden administration has taken very few, at least what's visible to the public, concrete policy changes since the state of exception was imposed to shift the United States' policy in a way that responds to the severity of the situation in El Salvador. And I think that's something, another dynamic that's going on here, because it's not as if the Biden administration came out really hard and all these right-wing allies came to Bukele's defense. And so I think there's more about where Bukele is trying to project for the future and the types of movements, the types of ideologies that he is seeking to align himself with. I think he's preparing himself and preparing the future diplomatic relations for, I can only presume, what he hopes will be a second Trump administration. Recently, El Salvador had a visit from Eric Prince, the infamous Blackwater founder. And not surprisingly, he made some of the same points that you're hearing from the El Salvador caucus. And so, you know, when Prince is very close with Trump, or was in a sort of private security advisor role. And so these types of meetings, these types of visits, these types of televised interviews that get spread virally on the internet, there's a lot of ideological alignment that we need to pay attention to there. And I think it has a lot to do, and it tells a lot, like you were saying before, about what are Bukele's policies truly like, and why is he being embraced by the far right in the U.S. and internationally, if that isn't also his position and he's not in a position to affect and be kind of a driving edge. Because he's reached a situation in which he is truly above the law in El Salvador, it's to the advantage of a lot of people in the U.S. and globally on the right for him to push the envelope. He has gotten to a situation where he can drive, he can be that leading edge for some really scary stuff that a lot of other people would love to be able to do. But because Bukele has moved himself above the law and has, you know, achieved near total power, at least on paper, in El Salvador, there's a reason why people would look to him to say, hey, maybe this can be the laboratory for the kind of things we'd like to be able to do.
Yes, Eric Prince, who's the founder of the mercenary group Blackwater, his interests in Latin America, not just El Salvador, is another hour-long conversation in and of itself. And I'm glad you mentioned his name, because this sort of turns our attention to one of the first acts by the El Salvador caucus, which was urging Secretary of State Anthony Blinken to lift the elevated travel advisory to El Salvador. Why does the travel advisory to El Salvador both contradict Bukele's rhetoric while also vindicating claims by human rights groups? I feel like you sort of alluded to this already, but I think these two things need further explanation here.
Yeah, the travel advisor, this is something that is issued by the State Department, and there's a sort of an elevated travel advisory to El Salvador right now. And the reasons that are stated in the advisory have everything to do with the arbitrariness of arrests under the state of exception, prison conditions, and the fact that there are, as it says, known cases of U.S. citizens and U.S. residents who have been detained under the state of exception. And so this represents, I think it is a very truthful and very important statement. And it, like you said, it aligns with, validates, and upholds all the reports that are coming from human rights organizations in El Salvador. And it's one of the only kind of policy pieces that we see from the Biden administration that's very clear and states very plainly the risks that the state of exception means, including, as they said, for U.S. citizens. And that's obviously a priority for the State Department. It's worth saying that the State Department's own human rights report that they issue every year is also very clear on the gravity of the situation in El Salvador. And that has been that way, you know, for the last year or two. And it's one of those moments where you see there's clearly full knowledge at the State Department level about the reality on the ground in El Salvador. And it's been very disappointing to see such a muted response in terms of policy changes in response to that. The travel advisory, however, is one of those pieces where you have the State Department kind of putting that into action. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's been a focal point for this right-wing camp that's trying to boost El Salvador in the United States and to, you know, align with presumably what Bukele's interests are regarding the U.S. policy as well. So the caucus wrote about the need to take out the travel advisory. And their argument, of course, being repeating the idea that El Salvador is safe now, so why is this travel advisory still here? That's the same thing we heard from Eric Prince. Like, with the success that you've had in these anti-gang efforts, why would the travel advisory be necessary? And kind of painting it out as if the Biden administration is some kind of adversary of Bukele. And of course, that aligns with a very, you know, fruitful right-wing conversation that, you know, the Biden administration is to be blamed for this because they're, you know, standing in the way of El Salvador's progress, et cetera. But I think taking the travel advisory away could have very important and serious repercussions in that, you know, as I said before, there are increasing number of people leaving El Salvador out of political persecution and are seeking political asylum, including in the United States. And for the U.S.'s own documents and own policies to say that there are dangers to people under the current state of exception of an arbitrary arrest, for example, then that is something that is important. It validates what asylum seekers are saying, that they are in danger in their own country.
That's important because, according to your article, travel advisories like the one that's on El Salvador right now is taken under consideration in asylum applications, correct?
I think the thing that has been a challenge is the dominance of the narrative that Bukele has made El Salvador safe is really in direct contradiction to the needs of many asylum seekers, of many immigrants who want and need to stay in the United States. And I don't think it's coincidence that this travel advisory would become like the point of contention. And as people in El Salvador have pointed out, it kind of highlights the contradiction. If El Salvador is so safe, why is there a travel advisory? And that kind of, you know, it goes against the image that Bukele is trying to put out there. And I think similar questions could be asked. If El Salvador is so safe, why are constitutional rights still suspended? Why are people living under a police state? If the gang problem has been solved, why is this measure continued to be necessary? It's clearly for other reasons. It's clearly to allow the state to maintain a repressive apparatus, to militarize communities, and to, like we said before, like create an environment where people are genuinely afraid to speak out or take action. And I think a lot of credit needs to be given to the organizations in El Salvador that are really confronting that head on and who are taking to the streets in the thousands to protest, to march, to mobilize, and to sort of expose the realities that they are living under despite this sort of cloud that's hanging over them.
Yeah, amazing as that information that you just gave us. We really just scratched the surface to all the other information that's included in the NACLA article that was written by CISPIS. We didn't even mention Lauren Boebert during the course of this conversation, or Corey Mills, who's another person who's a favorite of Bukele's as well. We didn't talk too much at all about LGBTQ rights, but that's only because we did a show on that back in June, so people can check that out as well, on how the state of exception affects LGBTQ rights in the country. And it's another reason of how people migrate, of why people migrate to the United States, because of things like that, all under this illegal umbrella of the state of exception. So, Alexis, like I said before, we're going to create a link to this article on our Twitter account. And I would encourage everyone to look at some of the photos in that article as well, because there's one of Bukele during the inauguration where he's saluting these soldiers. I believe they're soldiers. They look exactly like Pinochet. They look exactly like the same outfits that Augusto Pinochet in Chile wore during his dictatorship back in the 70s. It's not an exaggeration. It's not a joke. You have to check out the article to believe it. But in the 5 minutes that we have left, Alexis, what lessons do you hope people draw from this article, from the story, as the state of exception continues. Not just that, but also this public relations push that we're now seeing through this El Salvador caucus and how it's whitewashing what organizations like CISPES and CRISOSAL and many others have been talking about for some time now.
Thank you. I mean, I think the important thing is that what we're seeing now is sort of a response from this very ideologically driven group on the right. It's because something is starting to shift, I hope, in that there's an undeniability that's happening at the international level that has to and should implicate the United States' complicity with the situation. I mean, the United States is still the largest trainer and supporter of the Salvadoran police, of the Salvadoran military. And I think, obviously, that's not something that Gates and co. would challenge in terms of what the U.S. is doing in El Salvador, I would imagine. But I think for us, it's important to see this as a moment where something is starting to shake loose around the reality of the repression in El Salvador right now. And it is really important that people who are concerned about what's happening in El Salvador take advantage of this moment to push the Biden administration or whoever comes in office next to not allow the human rights atrocities to be whitewashed, to not normalize the authoritarian regime that has taken root in El Salvador, because there's an effort in order to do that. And the most important way to challenge that is to do the opposite, to not whitewash, to not normalize, to not just accept that this is something that is okay, is good in the long run. And I think to be able to get behind and lift up the incredibly courageous organizations on the ground in El Salvador, whether they're human rights defenders, legal organizations, mass movement organizations, who have been saying from day one that this is a strategy of political and social control, of repression and militarization, and that this is a vehicle by which Bukele is reverting the existence of a democracy that was created through the peace accords in 1992. People have been calling this for what it is from the beginning in El Salvador. And I think this is a key moment where we're seeing a concerted effort by a very ideological group in the United States to mainstream what Bukele is doing, that the response needs to be the complete opposite and to continue to demand even more strongly that the United States end its support, political and material, for the Bukele regime, including specifically ending support for military and police who are very clearly committing widespread human rights abuses, and the U.S. knows it.
I just want to iterate before we finish here that, again, you don't have to be completely immersed or knowledgeable of all politics in El Salvador to understand that the company that Nayib Bukele keeps with the likes of Tucker Carlson, Matt Gaetz, and Eric Prince should tell you enough about the political leanings and his authoritarian direction that he's taken the country. And this also explains the investment in lobbying in the United States. Matt Gaetz took the money, and it just shows his moral bankruptcy along the way. And so with that said, we've been speaking with Alexis Tumbelis, who's the executive director of CISPES, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. CISPES has a new article in NACLA entitled "New El Salvador Caucus Appears Set to Do Bukele's Bidding in Congress." And we're going to create a link to this article on our Twitter account so people can learn more. But in the meantime, Alexis Tumbelis, it's always a pleasure. It's always an honor. Thank you for being on the show with us today.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
for WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bengert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. An Israeli airstrike in Lebanon's capital Beirut today killed at least 8 people and wounded almost 60 others, the first such strike in months. The strike comes the same week that thousands of pagers and walkie-talkies exploded across Lebanon, killing at least 20 people and injuring thousands more. Lebanon's government and the Hezbollah militant group blamed Israel for the attack, though Israel has not claimed responsibility. Earlier today, Hezbollah fired 140 rockets into northern Israel and the occupied Golan Heights, some of which were intercepted. There were no reports of casualties from the Hezbollah strikes. In Gaza, Palestinian authorities said 15 people were killed in multiple overnight Israeli airstrikes. The United Nations General Assembly on Wednesday adopted a Palestinian-drafted resolution that demands Israel withdraw from the occupied Palestinian territories within the next year. The resolution also calls on countries to take steps to prevent trade or investments that maintain Israel's presence in the territories, as well as to halt the transfer of arms and munitions. 124 countries voted in favor of the resolution, while the top UN court in July that said Israel's presence in the Palestinian territories is unlawful and must end. And while the resolution is not legally binding, the extent of its support does reflect world opinion. In domestic news, the decommissioned Three Mile Island nuclear power plant, the site of the country's worst nuclear accident, plans to reopen under a 20-year deal with Microsoft to supply power for the company's AI data centers. Constellation Energy, which owns the Three Mile Island plant, said it hopes to bring the one functioning reactor online in 2028, assuming approval from relevant government agencies. The plant's second reactor was destroyed in the 1979 nuclear accident. The Microsoft deal comes as the Biden administration and other authorities are promoting nuclear power as a possible alternative to fossil fuels. The mayor of Springfield, Ohio, issued a proclamation on Wednesday claiming temporary emergency powers to, quote, mitigate public safety concerns as the city faces multiple threats of violence following false claims about Haitian immigrants. The proclamation grants Mayor Rob Rue temporary emergency powers to obtain and mobilize resources and address potential threats. Local officials say they have received more than 30 bomb threats, many forcing evacuations and closures since the second presidential debate, during which former President Trump repeated false claims that Haitian immigrants are stealing and eating local pets. In related news, Trump said he will be visiting Springfield, Ohio in the next 2 weeks. The former president made his announcement at a rally in Uniondale, New York on Wednesday night. Springfield Mayor Rue, who is a Republican, responded to the announcement by saying in a press conference, quote, "It would be an extreme strain on our resources, so it'd be fine with me if they decided not to make that visit," end quote. Leaders of the Teamsters Union decided on Wednesday not to endorse a presidential candidate in the upcoming election, after releasing internal polling that showed a majority of its members support former President Donald Trump. The decision comes after the nation's other major labor organizations, including the AFL-CIO, the American Federation of Teachers, and the United Auto Workers, have pledged their support for Vice President Kamala Harris. The Teamsters represent some 1.3 million truck drivers, freight workers, and others in the U.S. and Canada. The powerful union has endorsed the Democratic candidate for president ever since 1992. The last time the union endorsed a Republican was in 1988. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 81 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 77 degrees and partly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bingert-Drowns.